Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday morning. It's July 15th. Currently 65 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Heber City reporting 64 degrees. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Tuesday, Utah. It's time for your Wasatch Back forecast as we go into your Tuesday. And we're looking at lots of sunshine to start, but we're going to see scattered clouds developing throughout the day and just enough moisture to where we could see some isolated storms developing as we go into the afternoon hours. Now, those storms may not produce a lot of actual rainfall, but they may produce some lightning and some erratic gusty winds. So that's not only going to lead to some dangers with the lightning and some gusty winds, but we could also see a critical fire danger develop throughout the day. So we have a fire weather warning that's in effect for this afternoon into the evening hours for the dry conditions, the gusty winds, and the elevated fire danger that could develop if any sparks do get going across the region. But we're also going to have a chance, a level 1 out of 5 marginal risk for a couple of those isolated strong storms to develop. Again, not a lot of rainfall with those, but we could see some gusty erratic winds with those as well. So that's going to be the primary concern, possibly up to 50 to 60 miles per hour. So that's something to keep an eye on with those isolated storms. Otherwise, high temperatures are still going to be on the hot side despite the chance of isolated storms. Highs will climb to around 90 in Park City. We're looking at high temperatures in the mid-90s in the Heber Valley, again, with that slight moisture chance as we go throughout this afternoon. As we go into your Wednesday, we're looking at a little bit more of the same, mostly sunny skies expected out there. We'll keep that slight chance of another isolated storm or two developing in the afternoon. We're also going to add in a little smoke developing as well with some of those gusty winds bringing in some of the smoke across the area. So be aware of the potential of some smoky skies. Highs will be in the mid-80s for us as we go throughout your Wednesday afternoon in Park City. Highs in the low 90s in the Heber Valley. Now, once we get past that, we'll be looking at conditions improving slightly when it comes to some slightly drier air in place for us as we get into your Thursday and Friday. High temperatures because of that will climb back into the mid-80s, the upper 80s in Park City, with highs in the upper 80s to near 90 in the Heber Valley, and we stay that way into the upcoming weekend. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybow. He'll have a preview of this week's county council meeting, as well as taking a look at some of the topics being discussed. Two of the petitioners who are taking Summit County Clerk to court over the rejected petition signatures regarding the Dakota Pacific referendum, Angela Mosqueda and Reed Galen, in to talk about their next steps. And event organizers Charlotte Backus and Matthew Turner have details about the Uinta bikepacking trip. This is a 300-plus mile adventure happening later this year. Well, the executive director of the Egyptian Theater says that the iconic Park City venue will not host the Sundance Film Festival for the final festival in Park City this January. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more.
Executive Director Randy Barton confirmed to KPCW Monday there won't be any Sundance screenings at the Egyptian Theater come January. The iconic Main Street venue hosted the Sundance Film Festival when it moved to Park City in 1981, but is absent from the list of 2026 venues the Sundance Institute released Monday. The theater was initially absent from the 2025 venue list too, but later renegotiated a contract with the festival. Barton indicated there won't be any contract renegotiation this go around. After 2026, the Sundance Film Festival will move to Boulder, Colorado. Barton did not say the move influenced contract negotiations between his theater and the Sundance Institute and said the situation is, quote, all positive. Over text, he said, quote, no controversy here. Live performances is what we do, and we're no longer set up for film. He also mentioned the Egyptian Theater will celebrate its centennial in 2026. It opened on Christmas Day in 1926. A Sundance representative did not immediately return a request for comment. The venues confirmed for the 2026 Sundance Film Festival include Eccles Theater, Holiday Village Cinemas, Library Center Theater, the Ray Theater, and Redstone Cinemas. In Salt Lake City, there will be films at the Salt Lake Film Society's Broadway Center Cinemas and the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. Sundance will also screen movies at the Yarrow Doubletree Hotel next year. The last time the Yarrow hosted Sundance was in 2023. It has hosted the Slam Dance Film Festival. Off and on during the festival's run in Park City, Slam Dance positions itself as the edgier version of Sundance and announced a move to Los Angeles last year. Before Sundance moves away from Park City, it says it wants to honor both the town and its founder, actor Robert Redford. The festival announced a program of archival screenings, restorations, and special events to honor Park City, which has been home to the festival for four decades. It says Redford will be honored during its annual Sundance Film Festival celebration fundraiser on January 23rd at the Grand Hyatt Deer Valley. Park City Main Street will be pedestrian only again, too. The festival and local law enforcement blocked off the street for public safety this year, and some attendees said they enjoyed the car-free atmosphere. The 2026 Sundance Film Festival will run from January 22nd to February 1st. The Egyptian Theater is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the Wasatch County Council meets tomorrow starting at 4 o'clock. On the phone with a meeting preview is Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's see. Let's start with the fact that the county had its quarterly interlocal meeting with Heber and Midway last week. The agenda included a bypass update from UDOT. We got a first look at how local traffic could be affected by the bypass. So what do county leaders think of the bypass proposals so far?
I think there are still some concerns about some of these details of how do people get from one place to another and what some of those movements look like. But overall, I think the council's consistently been supportive of the bypass project as a whole. And we think there's still opportunities to make some of these adjustments.
Yeah, do you have any major concerns about the proposed routes?
The council hasn't brought it up for discussion yet. I know that once they produce the draft EIS, I expect the council will submit a formal comment during that open public comment portion of that.
Mm-hmm. And UDOT has been doing outreach to property owners there in the North Fields and along US 40, those who could be affected. Have county leaders heard much about what could happen with those property owners?
Yeah, my understanding is UDOT's reached out primarily to anyone whose property is under one of the alignments. And in some cases, they've already purchased property that's under both of the alignments. There are sections that are the same between the two of them, and so they have purchased a few properties along that and kind of let people know, hey, this is, you are in the alignment of this area and could be affected by it. So anytime that the bypass could affect the property, even if it's just a portion of the property, they've reached out to those property owners.
Mm-hmm. And they're, you say, buying what, just at fair market value? Is that how it works?
Yeah, I know actually a county employee who owned a house that was purchased that felt like they got a fair price for their home because it's underneath both alternatives.
Yeah, and is any of this property that could be under one of the routes protected under some kind of conservation easement? Because we've seen a lot of that happen in the North Fields.
Yeah, I don't know that there is any conservation easements that are in effect yet that would impact the bypass. I know that there were some that we had been considering and working with UDOT and the NRCS and the property owners, but I don't think there are any in place.
Mm-hmm. And is 2034 still a realistic deadline to finish this project?
It's pretty aggressive. I think it all comes down to the funding, that if enough funding were allocated to it through, it would ultimately have to be a variety of sources. I think it's achievable, and that's really going to be a question of political will.
All right. What about any updates on the Riverview Incorporation? That's the proposed town there for the North Fields.
You know, I know you reported on the public meeting that they had some weeks ago now, and I think they're in the part of the process where they are doing commissioning the studies necessary to demonstrate the viability of the proposed town. But other than that, I haven't been included in any information on it.
All right. The interlocal agenda also included a presentation about Engine House. I was guessing this was the affordable housing development here in Park City.
Yes, actually. We had some staff and elected officials attend some broader discussions at the Economic Summit, the Wasatch BAC Economic Summit, and thought it would be helpful to get more Wasatch County elected officials kind of just to see what options are out there, and public-private partnerships are one area that I don't know that we've explored very thoroughly yet.
Mm-hmm. So what was discussed then?
They kind of reported on, how Engine House worked and kind of what are the pressure points and what are the things to consider as we go through that process. I think there was a suggestion, you know, that through annexation proceedings and in the municipalities, they could require property that could be dedicated for affordable housing. And we kind of talked about other properties that might be available for this type of use and where they should go and things like that.
Yeah, I was going to ask, I mean, does Wasatch County have property that something like that could be built on?
There are some properties that may have some potential. You know, Wasatch County purchased a number of properties for what was then the bypass alignment. And there may be portions of those properties that will fall inside of the bypass on the Heber City side of that. That may be an opportunity, but ultimately those end up being kind of on the edge of town and may not be the best place for that type of use.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure as you heard, this is being done through a public-private partnership, right? Because the city owned the land and basically offered a land lease to the developer to make this affordable and able to do that. Does Wasatch County, I mean, do you have public-private partnerships that you operate under as well?
So that was the discussion, is that's not an area that we really have taken advantage of yet, but one that, you know, I think affordable housing is such a big issue, it's going to need an all-of-the-above kind of an approach. And so I think educating ourselves in meetings like this and generating some of the political will to tackle some of these hairy issues was part of the discussion.
Yeah. And are there different affordable housing plans that could be coming soon to the Heber Valley?
Yeah, I know Heber City has been working on, I think, aggressive plans for deed-restricted units through the annexation proposals that they had. I think that was part of this discussion, too, is that it doesn't have to be just that. Again, we want to try to be all of the above of as much as we can do to move the needle at all. That's going to be helpful, but ultimately, you know, not going to be able to, there's no silver bullets to this issue, right?
Yeah. And are you talking specifically senior housing anywhere?
Yeah, we do have some senior housing that have been done by the Wasatch Affordable Housing Board. I know it's very popular and well utilized, but there's obviously demand for more that we don't have in the works at the moment.
All right. Richard Breitenbecker, the county's MIDA liaison, shared an update on development in the East Village. Can you tell us what's new in that area of the county?
Yeah, I think part of that update is really just bringing everyone up to speed of what the progress has been so far. And anyone who's driven by that Mayflower interchange can see that there's just a lot of construction there. There is a hotel that's planned to be completed early next year. That's the Hilton Canopy at kind of the north end there. And there are other hotels that are under construction. The Four Seasons is under construction. And there's another five-star hotel around the corner from there. And some of those details, really, it's the plan kind of coming to fruition. So I don't know if there's really any changes that Richard was reporting on, more just updates of how things have been progressing.
Yeah, I just heard this about, you know, with the Four Season construction going up, it basically blocks the entire view of everything that's in the Grand Hyatt except for the very upper floors. Everybody knows about that?
Yeah, there is a division between the two towers of the Four Seasons, but again, I think this has kind of always been the plan. There are a number of hotels that will go into that area, and I think they're trying to be conscious of particular view sheds, but not necessarily particular rooms view sheds, right? So that these would be views from the Mayflower Interchange and other parts of the county as you come up over the crest of the hill and things like that, and how they impact the ridgelines and things like that. Those are things that MIDA has in their code for consideration.
Yeah, so are these the 100 rooms that are being offered to the military? Is that the view they get?
You know, I don't know exactly which rooms in the MWR hotel are dedicated to the military, or which specific rooms they are, but, you know, I think, again, this was kind of always the plan of that there was going to be a hotel on one side of the street and a hotel on the other. And I think they've done their best to try and make accommodations where possible.
Yeah. So what's ahead in the next few months?
I think we'll see a lot more construction. I know anybody who's been over by there has also seen the helicoptered ski lifts. I think they're hoping to get most of those online for this next winter season. So they're working really as quickly as they can to make sure that the winter season has as much of the terrain open as possible.
Yeah, and do you feel like MIDA is fulfilling its mission to veterans with the project so far?
Absolutely. I think if you pay attention to the wide variety of military benefits that MIDA provides. It's not just those 100 rooms that they are working with another developer on what are some day use amenities that local veterans and active military members would be able to take advantage of. There is a partnership with disabled veterans and being able to accommodate their families as they go through treatment and recovery. And there's quite a bit. There's a military conference and kind of business space over at the Sky Ridge Hotel, which is part of the consideration over there. And also with that, MIDA's purpose is a dual purpose, which also includes economic development. And I think it's pretty unequivocal. MIDA has been able to move the needle in progress in this area that the county has been working on for decades, that's really, again, coming to fruition now.
All right. Let's see, the county's in the middle of its general plan update. Why does this big government document matter to the average person?
You know, that's a good question, because a lot of people probably don't even know what a general plan is, or that every land use entity is required to have one. A general plan is the governing document, kind of like a constitution is for the country. A general plan says what Wasatch County or any other entity is going to be and is going to do, and anything that Wasatch County does, we use the general plan as a guiding direction for what we do and why we do it. Many times people want to engage at the very end of a development process. You know, they're concerned about a specific proposal that comes forward and think, hey, I don't want this thing to go forward. But really the input is most important at the beginning of the process, and this general plan update is as early in the beginning as you can get. So providing feedback on where appropriate densities are going to go and who we want to be as a community, those type of visioning statements, which is the early process that we're working on now, are really crucial to getting the end result that we want, which is a community that reflects many of the positive attributes of what we have now while mitigating some of those negative impacts of growth and other changes.
Yeah, what kind of community involvement has there been so far?
So we did a pretty robust community survey. We got over 400 responses to that survey, and we are now working with focus groups on specific areas of the general plan. There are four different areas within the general plan that we are kind of coordinating, getting community feedback. We also presented to the Planning Commission some vision statements that are for each of those areas that we can again use as guiding lights as we divide this project up into the pieces that we go in and as we move forward. So we hope that people can pay attention to those processes at the Planning Commission. We're also going to have some public outreach as we kind of get further along and as we reach some milestones within that process.
Okay, so there will be more opportunities for locals to share their thoughts.
Yes.
Okay. We heard from Heber Chamber Executive Director Dallin Kosher recently about a new event, the Wasatch County Heritage Festival. It's supposed to happen this September. So what's the county's role in this? Are you helping financially?
Yeah, so actually we have a resolution on this week's agenda to express support for the Heber Valley Heritage Festival that the Chamber is hoping to promote. I think we're hoping that they will apply for a TAP grant, and that could be a valuable source of funding. I think it's also possible that there are other funding sources. We have Wasatch County in the past, and along with Heber City, and I believe Midway City, contributed to what is now no longer taking place, the Cowboy Poetry Festival. And so there are some funds left over from that we're hoping might be able to be reallocated into this new kind of spiritual successor event that can kind of honor the heritage of Wasatch County.
Yeah, so what heritage are we talking about? I mean, are we going back to Native Americans, or are we talking about present day, or are we just talking about Mormon pioneers?
I think it's all of the above. I know that they were hoping, we've had the some Native American presentations and events in Wasatch County in the past, and they're hoping that this can be an opportunity to get them to come back, even with some financial support, to show that aspect of the history. I think the Mormon pioneers is a part of the history of the Valley, as are the agricultural kind of heritage that's taken place since that time. And so I think we want to honor and respect as much of it as we can get. I think that's part of why we've been discussing as well this historian position, to make sure that we're covering as many bases as possible when we talk about what this valley was and how we want to communicate that going forward.
Yeah, and I guess I kind of look back at the meeting from last week, the Planning Commission meeting, you know, where we talk about stupid Californians, you know, somebody mentioning that in the Planning Commission meeting, talking about the general plan, and it's kind of like, oh, so that's part of the heritage too.
Yeah, you know, change is hard, and you know, I think it's interesting if you look at net migration in Wasatch County, we get a lot of people from a lot of different places, and we have, are an increasingly diverse community. And so I think that, with that change always comes a little bit of growing pains, but we hope that we can kind of move past any of those negative things. And again, as we are conscious about who we want to be and how we want to govern our growth, that I think we can make really mindful choices and have those positive impacts.
Yeah, it just any concern by you, though? I mean, when we have county officials talking like that?
You know, I don't think the county would ever want to disparage any groups. You know, every person who lives in Wasatch County is a constituent of Wasatch County and somebody that we protect. It's funny, most people like their neighbors, regardless of where they're from, they like the they don't like the unknown other person that they don't know. And the reality is, what we as Wasatch County hope to do is foster better connections. Because we think if everybody can kind of connect a little bit more, some of those negative feelings can go away.
All right. Wanted to ask about the council last week approved the e-bike ordinance, it sounds like. Now, how does it get enforced?
Yeah, so what we're hoping to do is work with Heber City and Midway City to be able to do a public information campaign to make sure that people are aware of it. We have been coordinating with the sheriff's office as well. Heber City has been working with their police department. And what we're hoping is that this more uniform approach to regulations around e-bikes and other motorized vehicles, that we can have a lot of consistency. And I think what we're looking at is kind of moving in through stages of public information, because there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of misunderstanding out there right now about what's an e-bike and what's not, and where can you use them and where is not appropriate to use them. So we think the first step in that process is a lot of robust education.
Okay. And the county is looking for a new Parks and Recreation Director. What's the process for that?
So right now, the Parks and Recreation District has had a recruitment out. I believe they received 35 applications and are reviewing those for interviews. I'm on that selection committee, as are three other council members and a member of the public well. And so we as a selection committee are going to work to narrow that list down to a smaller group and then present it to the council at a future meetings, future interviews and things like that.
Okay. Dustin, anything else you want to mention?
No, not today.
All right. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
That's Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Well, as we reported, a group of five Summit County residents are taking legal action against the Summit County Clerk over her rejection of some 30 signature packets that were submitted in an attempt to require a public vote after the Summit County Council approved Ordinance 987, the revised Dakota Pacific Development Agreement. In the studio to explain why they filed the lawsuit, when Senate Bill 26 essentially permits the development agreement between the county and Dakota Pacific Real Estate for a mixed-use development, including as many as 885 residential units at Kimball Junction, I have Angela Mosqueda and Reed Galen. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
So you've been talking about filing a lawsuit or an injunction for a while now. Did you have to wait for the county clerk to actually declare the ordinance petition was insufficient before you move forward here?
Good morning, Leslie. And yes, there were some steps to follow, some procedural things. So yeah, we had to wait until there was injury, essentially, and that was declaration of insufficiency in order to then pursue an administrative appeal.
All right. So neither of you were original sponsors of the referendum. What gives you legal standing now to file this lawsuit?
Being Summit County residents. I think technically anybody who is a Summit County resident could do this, but Reed and I were both pretty involved through the entire petition process. We both volunteered as signature gatherers.
Right, and having been through this so many times, you know, for us, the idea of so many Park City residents, Summit County residents coming out to show their support for this concept, even for this idea, for this referendum via their signatures, from our perspective, it was important. It is important for us to see this through as far as we can.
All right. And why did only two of the original sponsors then join in on this lawsuit. The other five just weren't interested?
Not that they weren't interested, and I've had conversations with all of them. I think nobody understood what this was going to turn into. And to be fair, it was a lot for people. Names out there, direct outreach from Dakota Pacific trying to pressure the sponsors from the beginning. Names being in the press, you know, things just get challenging. And people have different things going on in life, work, family, kids. It just became really, really stressful in ways that I would say the original sponsors didn't anticipate.
And it's a team effort, right? I mean, this is not the kind of thing that one person can put on their shoulders and carry forward. It's going to take a variety of people, whether or not they're residents, they're people, the attorneys, people who have a vested interest in it, seeing Summit County, you know, be developed. It's not a matter of not developing. That's not the issue, right? I mean, we've been here 10 years, and, you know, we just had our 10-year anniversary here in Park City last week. This, as you all know, especially you, Leslie, like, the town isn't even remotely what it was even when we got here. And so from our perspective, it's, yet look, development is going to happen. But should all of the rigmarole, all of the different things, all of the ins and outs, all of this ultimately leading up to the Dakota Pacific being so desirous of a plan that they wanted, that suited their needs and no one else's, that they went all the way to the legislature, from our perspective, you know, we'll take help where we get it. And to Angela's point, look, I do this for a living. A lot of people, like, they have other stuff going on, rightfully so.
Yeah, and are there some financial concerns here as well? Because you are now paying attorneys?
Yes. You and I have had conversations about how frustrated I get by this, that it really falls on the backs of residents to invest considerable time and considerable money just to uphold the code. There was significant cost associated with the petition process. The printing of, there were 77 packets all in all in the end turned in. The printing costs reached into the thousands of dollars. People spent their own money on signs and cards and other ways to promote the petition. And now, yes, these legal costs will be high. There is a GoFundMe. Somebody can just look up Protect Summit County if they want to find that online and throw a few bucks that way.
Yeah. So as reported late last week, the clerk's office now has agreed to a stipulated order to go ahead and verify the signatures that she rejected. How is it that you got Clerk Efers to go along with this?
There may have been some alternatives that would have been aggressive and even more expensive. And I would just like to think that at this point, you know, the will of Summit County voters is clear. I think we see that in the over 6,000 people that signed the petition. Many, many emails were sent into the clerk from people saying, I signed, I know what I signed, the packet was there, I would like my signature to count. Of course, she can't just reverse process. But I think that this was a way for the clerk, and then now as of yesterday, the lieutenant governor, who Eve had suggested previously was advising her, to sort of step out of the way and just leave it in the hands of the court. The reason that it was so important for this stipulated order to be agreed to when it was and for the signatures to be counted is because we're fighting the clock a little bit here. We will go before Judge Mrazek sometime in August for a hearing. But the thing is that ballots, right, the ballot design has to be finalized and sent to the printer at the end of August in order for those ballots to be delivered in time for the November election. So presuming, you know, hoping that Mrazek rules in our favor, if we waited for that to happen, then what we would miss is the 45-day mandatory period for people to remove their signatures. So what happened now is Clerk Efers counted up the signatures. She delivered them to the Lieutenant Governor yesterday. Lieutenant Governor posted them. That 45-day signature period has begun for anybody who is part of this new batch, right? That was in packets 1 through 30. Their signatures are now online. They can fill out a form and remove them if they'd like. That process will wrap up, and then we await Mrazek's ruling.
So that's what the clerk has been doing then, is just verifying the rest of those packets that she had originally rejected.
Exactly.
Yep. All right. So we've got the total number of signatures verified to move this forward?
Well, verified at least from a this is a registered Summit County voter. The signature was right. clear. The address checks out, right? But Mrazek is the one who will now determine whether or not packets 1 through 30 are valid. If he says no, then that's the end of the line. And if he says yes, then we are on the ballot in November.
Right. And again, it was these 30 packets because they had three-ring binder holes in them, as opposed to the other 47 that had just spiral bound.
Right. And as Angela has said several times, many times actually, that the state law does not stipulate what the technical definition of binding is. It was our opinion, and I think that we are being borne out here, that binding is one of those things that is subjective, and the clerk chose to take a very conservative view of it based on what I would say is pretty spotty evidence. And so we're very pleased that she decided to move forward.
Yeah, and I guess to me that's going to be the issue here, because we have your opinion about that they are, in fact, they meet state law. She says no. Judge Mrazek will decide, who is not ever happy with that ruling. It now goes on to the Court of Appeals. I mean, it doesn't sound like it's going to end in Third District Court.
Well, as Angela said, I think the issue is that we're up against the clock, which is if we're not able to get this done prior to ballots being printed, then it becomes a very difficult thing, because now how do you get on the ballot for November 2025? And so that's really the issue at this point.
But again, can that be done? Because this takes years to get to the, you know, the Supreme Court is what I'm thinking.
Well, I would say this, is that if we are successful in front of the judge, the clerk would have to decide she wants to appeal. And I would hope at this point, after all of this work and after thousands of signatures, that the clerk would say, okay, you know what, this is the people's will, this is the judge's will, we'll let this go.
All right. Well, as we know, the Utah legislature passed Senate Bill 26, which supports the development agreement between Summit County and Dakota Pacific, which appears to render this lawsuit moot, because it doesn't matter how many signatures you collected or how many packets are declared invalid. The new law includes language that allows the development. So shouldn't you be challenging that law?
I'm going to challenge that interpretation. And my guess is that that's coming from County Manager Shane Scott. And if you look at his language and the statements he's made, it's nuanced. What SB 26 assures is the new development agreement that it allows. What we are trying to preserve is the original development agreement. So they definitely got craftier this time. They got a lot smarter. When they went and sought this legislative intervention, they made it such that this new development agreement does not go before the council, it goes before the county manager. It is now considered administrative, not legislative. Therefore, you know, we even discussed this with our attorneys. They said, is it possible that you maybe just go and run a ballot referendum around this new development agreement? We are precluded from doing that, and that's why the fight for this original Ordinance 987 is so critical to preserving our ability to stay in this. So really, what we're looking at is, first and foremost, we have to get Ordinance 987 on the ballot. If we do, and if it succeeds as a ballot referendum, then it becomes a constitutional fight, right? Does SB 26, which was presented and considered and signed after we began this referendum process, does that take precedence, or do we? But we have no say in that fight if we don't win this one first.
All right. Well, I guess, so what is it that you and your co-plaintiffs are hoping to achieve? I mean, is it just about procedural accountability, or about stopping the project entirely?
Well, again, I think, as Angela just said, it's the reversion, I guess is the right word, to an original development agreement. But the most important part here, as Angela also noted, is we have to get on the ballot, we have to pass the measure so that we can then take the next step to say that, you know, the legislature overstepped. Because I think, look, this is not going to stop here. The legislature will do this again. In fact, why would the Dakota Pacifics of the world ever come before the Summit County Council or the Wasatch County Council or any county council, if they could just go to the legislature 3 days before the end of session, say, here's what we want to do, here's what we need to do, here's what we want to do, and of course they're going to pass it with about 15 minutes left, and you know, Spencer Cox will sign it. So I think there are larger implications, more than just what Dakota Pacific is doing. It's what else others, including that company, want to do going forward.
Yeah. We're kind of running out of time here, and I guess it is supporters of the project say that this will bring much-needed housing and economic development. And I guess, do you guys acknowledge any potential benefits from the project? And if so, why don't they outweigh your concerns?
I just, you know, I go back to, it was the remember the big meeting in Redstone, 2021, right, with all those people in the room. And I remember how bad their presentation was. Like, so bad, Leslie, that I got up and said, you should be ashamed. Like, you should fire the people who did this for you because it was so ridiculous. There were people in the crowd, longtime Summit County residents, who were laughing at the assumptions they were making about traffic and about what it was going to do. Not only that, you know, the county has gone through and, you know, they've used tax increment financing and all these other things that really put the county on the hook for a lot of things and let Dakota Pacific off the hook for a lot of costs. And they're like, oh, it's going to produce $120,000 worth of tax revenue annually. Really? $120,000? Like, that's a lot of money. Not in Summit County and not for the scope of what they want to do.
And I also just want to bring up one other point to your lawsuit. You take issue with just the starting date of all of this. I mean, we're talking 24 hours that you think will make a difference in terms of where we count it from, July or January 16th?
Because actually then the deadline fell on a Sunday, right? And so it was technically extended to Monday. I don't think that's the point there. The point is that the sponsors are the ones who were so clear on the code, on the procedure, and that it was the sponsors that had to point out to the county clerk's office, you've missed a critical step here, and we can't legally begin. And I think really that just gives credence to how seriously the sponsors took this from start to finish, including on the matter of binding.
All right. Wanted to bring up one more time that you have launched a GoFundMe campaign to help cover your legal costs. If you lose, are you on the line for the county's legal bills as well? Sometimes that's like a...
It's a great question, Leslie. We'll have to find that out because that'd be a good one to know.
Okay. And then I will sell a kidney.
Yes, that's all right. We're already lining up buyers.
All right. Tell me anything else that you'd like to let our listeners know about with regard to this?
No, just updates will be on Protect Summit County, and if you can chip in, please do.
Angela?
Same. Yep. Just we need all the help that we can get at this point.
All right. And we're hoping, I believe, to bring on County Clerk Efers tomorrow, so stay tuned for that.
We will.
Will do.
All right. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Angela Muscata and Reed Galen, again, the two of those who have sued Summit County Clerk's Office. A local couple have put together what's called a bike packing race over 300 miles of Utah's single track from the Jordan Elm to the Starvation Reservoir. In the studio with details, I have Charlotte and Matthew Turner. Good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Charlotte, we found out about this. You're one of KPCW's community advisory board members. I guess that's how we found out about it. But tell us how you came up with this idea.
Well, it was me and my husband, Matthew. It's been a couple years. A couple years ago, he'd been getting into bike packing. We're both former pro road and mountain bike racers. So we met in college, and 2 years ago, I randomly made a route. And he was like, okay, this is actually great. And I was like, really? I literally just made this. And so we started piecing it together. And then the beginning, I had started to get into ultra racing because he did a few years ago. And after about a year ago, we were just starting to scout the route and we're like, let's make this a thing. And I wanted to really pull in the community also.
Sure. So ultra racing is what?
I would say ultra racing is anywhere from 24 hours plus on the bike, and in the bike packing world, it's mostly all self-supported. So you kind of have a start where everyone starts together, but once you're out there, you're finding water and resupply from any kind of neutral source that everyone has access to.
Yeah. So you've got a route. What else? I mean, do you have dates at this point?
Yeah, we're getting close. We definitely know it's September 2026. We don't have the exact day yet, but this year we will be doing the entire route ourselves to just kind of make sure everything's good to go. Because, I mean, it's over 300 miles of single track, back roads, not much paved roads, which we like. And so there's a lot that's involved in this route, knowing, okay, what spots have good water. Because we also don't want to make a route that people struggle with. We want to make it fun and exciting and see all the new places they haven't seen. So, yeah, we're hoping September 2026 is somewhere the month. We'll get the days soon.
Okay. And so how does it work? I mean, people just get on a bike and start riding?
Yeah, so for the most part, it's not really a registration fee. So it doesn't cost, there's not a big cost for people to join. What we're going to ask is for a donation to a charity or a local nonprofit to sign up. And then basically there's a date that we choose. So we're most likely end of September when the nice fall colors are out. And yeah, everyone starts at a certain time, 6 o'clock. And then it's kind of your support yourself till you get to the finish.
Yeah. How long would it take? You guys haven't ridden it at this point, so you don't know?
At this point, probably for the front of the group, they probably will end up not really sleeping at all. So it's, a lot of sleep deprivation, and they're pushing pretty hard. So they'll probably finish in 2 to 3 days.
All right. So when you talk about bike packing, what is it that they would bring with them? Nutrition, water? A water filter, pillow. I don't know.
Yeah, pretty much. If you're going backpacking, it's a similar thing. So majority of the people aren't going to be the people at the front, being very minimal and just pushing through the night. They're going to bring sleeping pads, sleeping bag, a tent, and just camp out at night and ride during the day and make it a kind of a similar to backpacking, but everything's strapped to your bike.
All right. So would there be kind of a deadline by the time they would have to arrive to kind of finish the race?
Yeah, after riding it this fall and figuring out kind of the timeline and what it takes to get around the 300 miles, we'll kind of outline kind of a deadline that we expect people to finish.
Yeah. So what type of bikes are people riding? I mean, would a gravel bike work better than a mountain bike?
We're finding that it's probably more of a mountain bike. It can get pretty rugged, and the last bit of it is up the Wow Trail. So we would recommend either a drop bar mountain bike or a mountain bike. Gravel bike, I mean, you could probably get away with it, but it'd be hard. It'd be really hard.
All right, so kind of give us an idea of the route. I mean, is it gonna be a big loop, or is it gonna kind of be an out and back?
It's gonna be a big loop. We like loops here. and we'll start here in Park City. We don't have a starting location quite yet, but we're hoping to get one soon. And you go up through Wasatch. So you pass Dornell, Wolf Creek, and then you go over to Strawberry, then Starvation. Oh, no, Starvation, then Strawberry. It's just a big, like, clockwise loop.
Okay. Yeah, Strawberry's before Starvation.
So yeah, Starvation.
Yeah, you'd hit one or the other, yeah. So what sort of permissions do you need to kind of pull this all together?
Yeah, so for the most part, we're working through getting permitting through the state parks, so Wasatch State Park, Dornell, and then just talking with the Forest Service and getting that permission to use those Forest Service roads as well.
Okay. You do have a website, and there's not a whole lot of detail on it yet, but you'll be adding to that, I'm guessing, as things go along?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, how about the route? Is that posted at this point?
That's going to be launching this fall. So after we kind of figure out the entire route, we'll launch the route, because I know everyone's super excited to see the full route. We've done a few sneak peeks, and then people can look at us on Strava and kind of piece it together. But yeah, we'll be launching that this fall.
Okay, you mentioned there's not going to be a registration fee. Why not? Does that mean you have to take care of people then that way? Or you're putting a lot of work into it. I guess, how do you get your time back?
A lot of times when you're asking for profit and registration, the Forest Service and stuff will ask for a more amount of payment towards them as well, and different permits and stuff, because you're more of like this income event. So it's just, and it's for the community, so we're not really doing it to make any money. We just want to put out a route out there and have our friends and everyone else who's interested join and kind of learn something new.
Yeah. So what kind of feedback have you gotten from it so far?
Great feedback. I mean, the ultra cycling world it's a really special world. It can be competitive, but it's also really about nature and the pack in, pack out kind of situation and doing things with friends and doing hard things with friends or really hard things. And so, like, we've gotten a lot of our friends who are excited. Some of our friends will be joining us this fall and doing some parts of the course. I think my dad's even kind of excited about it. So yeah, it's a very hard route, but you know, anyone can start on the line and see how far they can get. We will have like the day of the race or the event, or more like the weekend. We will try to like notify like our family members and friends if people need help getting picked up. Because it happens, you know, mechanicals happen or you just push it too hard. So we also want to have that availability. Instead of feed zones, we're going to have like bailout situations for people.
Yeah. Any idea what the elevation gain is going to be on something like this?
It's going to be around 40 to 50,000 feet of elevation gain total. And kind of on another note where Charlotte was talking about the bailout options, it's a requirement to have a satellite tracking device. So there's a lot of parts of the course where there's no cell service or anything like that. So having that, you can message, if it's not a too big of a deal, you can message someone you know and have them kind of assist you if you need to get rescued. Otherwise, you have the final resource of the SOS button and search and rescue is
okay. Awesome. Anything else you want to let us know about this time? What's the website?
It's Uinta Bikepacking. It's our way of kind of saying, are you into bikepacking, but the Uintas, because you're hanging around the Uintas. So uintabikepacking.com, and we're also on Instagram at uintabikepacking. We post occasionally, and we're doing some more sneak peeks, and we're excited. If anyone has questions, they can just reach out to us at info.uintabikepacking.
Okay, that sounds pretty amazing, Charlotte. Yeah. Matthew, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.